prelude. Musical prelude.
Good morning and welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Community Church of Hendricks County. I'm Annie Johnson, a member of your board. Sunday is that day when we gather together to deepen our spirituality and support each other in our free and responsible search for truth and meaning in our lives. If you are a visitor, and we have several today, which is wonderful, we are delighted you are here. If you're interested in receiving further information, please fill out a visitor's card that can be found on the table at the back of the sanctuary, also on the table around here, and I believe there's some downstairs also. After service, please stay with us for coffee hour. We would love to get to know you. Whatever your faith, whatever your heritage, today you are part of our religious community. We keep up to date with church happenings through our newsletter, but each Sunday we generally have a few announcements to either highlight or add to that information. Our upcoming services on May 26th, Bill Breeden will be here, Ceasefire Reflections on the Crisis in Gaza. If you don't know Bill, it's a treat to get to know him. He's actually the only person who was ever arrested and convicted relative to the Iran-Contra affair. And it was for stealing a sign down in Bloomington that had one of the generals who was helping run that campaign, a street sign that they named a street. He didn't think it should be named that. But anyway, I digress. June 2nd, Warren Rosenberg, and I believe Warren is from Wabash University, conducting difficult conversations. Pardon? Wabash College. I'm sorry. Thank you for correcting me, Diane. On January 9th, Daniel Bell, who is a school board member in Plainfield, being on a public school board in these crazy times. And June 16th is Poetry Appreciation Sunday. So be looking up your favorite poems to come share. In the spirit of fellowship and community, please take a moment to greet those around you.
Please rise as J. Eliot lights our chalice.
This chalice burns with twin flames. The first flame burns for those who seek and defend the right to be free, to be a free and responsible search for truth and meaning so that each person may live accordingly to his conscience in a democratically elected society. The second flame burns for the defenders of freedom, working against those who would impose their own religious beliefs on others through intimidation or legislation. May we tend this fire always, ever vigilant and courageous in the struggle for freedom and justice for all.
We, the Unitarian Universalist Community Church of Hendricks County, are a vibrant spiritual community with many facets, united together by our covenant. Please rise in body or spirit for the affirmation of our covenant, the words of which are in your order of service. We proudly carry the flame of religious freedom. We respect the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. We encourage each other to spiritual growth that makes for peace, ethical living, and community service. This is our covenant. Our reading today is a short excerpt from the Treaty of Tripoli, which was signed in 1797 by President John Adams. And I would also note that when this was signed by President Adams, before it was signed by him, it was voted on by the Senate, and it was passed unanimously by the Senate. As the government of the United States of America is not, in any sense, founded on the Christian religion, as it has in itself no character of enmity against the laws, religion, or tranquility of Muslims, and as the said states never entered into any war or act of hostility against any Mohammedan nation, it is declared by the parties that no pretext arising from religious opinions shall ever produce an interruption of the harmony existing between the two countries. And now Julian has a song for us. Our speaker today is Peter Harrington. Peter was born in Watertown, Massachusetts on May 14th, 1752. He died at age 61 on July 29th, 1813. Peter's fifth great-grandson, Bill Harrington, is an attorney with a practice located just around the corner here in Danville. I now welcome to the podium Peter Harrington.
How does a ragtag volunteer army in need of a shower somehow defeat a global superpower? How do we emerge victorious from the quagmire in the battlefield, waving Betsy Ross's flag higher? Yeah, it turns out we have a secret weapon, an immigrant. You know we love who's unafraid to step in. He's constantly confusing, compounding the British engine. Everyone give it up for America's favorite fighter, Branson!
Oh my gosh.
Now that was a tad dramatic, wasn't it? Unintended. These curious little devices you Americans have, I'm going to talk about that more later. I must confess that over these last 5 days, I have been binge listening to the music by Mr. Miranda. I don't know why he decided to sing about Hamilton, not really a very interesting figure, you know. But beside that, I find it to be quite fetching. My name is Peter Harrington. A
mere 5 days ago, feedback, on May 14 of 1813, I was celebrating my 61st birthday with my family in Watertown, Massachusetts. Apparently, I imbibed a bit much and slumbered. Unlike Mr. Irving's character, Van Winkle, I didn't sleep for just 20 years, but 211 years, somehow happened upon this very unfamiliar place. Lucky for me, two members of your congregation, Natalie Brake and Nancy Highhill, found me wandering about, and I'm not sure what it was about my modest attire that caught their attention, but as soon as they saw me, they suggested, "Might you speak to our church? Where and whence are you from?" And when I told them that I was a founder of the generation, early 19th century, in Boston, they looked at me and said, "Could you answer the question, was America founded as a Christian nation?" I must confess, at first I laughed. Such an absurd question, really. But they seemed so genuine in their regard. And I thought to myself, what is this modern place? Who are these Americans who are apparently so lost and have so forgotten their history that they need a simple soul like me to wander down a rabbit hole 211 years later and show up and answer this question? But I've always so well regarded the Unitarians and the Universalists, I decided I just might help, and so I'm here today. Nancy and Natalie told me of a monarchical figure, a former president named Trump, who apparently promises to make America great again by returning it to its Christian roots. I've seen this Trump figure on what you call TV during the last 5 days, and he rather reminds me of King George III, pompous, ignorant, and an unpleasant fellow, if ever there was one. But as I said, having always highly regarded the Unitarians and the Universalists, I thought, perhaps I'm here to help. Perhaps that's why I've arrived here 211 years later. And by the way, my friends, I'm so glad that you Unitarians and Universalists finally got together. I always thought that it was a match just waiting to be made. I have been reading voraciously over the last 5 days, curious at what has happened in America between 1813 and now 2024, I understand. I read of George Santayana, a Spanish writer from 1915, in a book called The Life of Reason, who wrote that those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it, which fed right into my desire in my reading over the last 5 days to gain some wisdom about how America ended up in this state of disarray and uncertainty. The surprisingly uninformed question that I was asked to answer was America founded as a Christian nation? Proves the point to me that you have truly lost your way. For example, only 1 month ago, April 19, a date that you don't celebrate. For goodness sake, how can you forget April 19? 1775, Lexington Green. The day we American rebels first fired upon the British redcoats. Emerson wrote about it in 1837 in his Concord hymn. The day the shot was fired heard round the world. There were two groups of Harringtons on Lexington Green. Those who survived, like me, because we were in Buckman's Tavern, and those who didn't survive, who survived by their name on a plaque. There are 11 dead cousins of mine on Lexington Green. How does America not celebrate that day when we stood up and decided to take action against the British Crown? Even your own recent history seems to escape you. and your curious ongoing relationship between government and religion. And so, I need a volunteer. And if one doesn't come forward, I will pick one. Who would wish to volunteer? How about our service leader? Teresa seems a good victim. What do you see before you, Teresa?
I see a fan with a picture of clouds and a flag.
And what's written on it?
The Pledge of Allegiance.
What's different about that Pledge of Allegiance?
It says, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
What's strange about that, Teresa?
It does not say under God.
It doesn't say under God. Do you know when it was, Teresa, that America decided to add the words under God to their Pledge of Allegiance? Really close. You get points for that.
Okay.
It was President Eisenhower in June of 1954 who signed an act that added under God. Because, of course, we were fighting the godless communists at the time, and we had to prove that when we pledge allegiance, that we do so under God. Quiz number two. You're still standing. I'm going to hand you $2 bills. One of them is from 1935, and one is fairly modern. Please look at the $2 bills. Study them. What do you see that might be different? And it's not the fact that one of them is a silver certificate. Don't worry about that part. You can turn them over. Aha.
The old one does not say.
Aha. You see, it was in 1935, the very last time that the dollar bill was printed without the words, In God We Trust, on the reverse. And so there has, thank you, your quiz is over. There will be another, so be at the ready. Excuse me. And so you see, there is this ongoing curious relationship of the American government with notions of registering whether we do so under God or in the trust of God. And for some reason, in the 20th century, it started to work its way back into the American conscience. And let it say, it is more in the American conscience now, at least some who wish to vote for that monarchical figure, than it has been for a long time. As you think about the question of whether America was founded as a Christian nation, please do not forget the historical context from which we founders came, most of us from Europe or England. In Europe, during the Age of Enlightenment in France, late 17th, early 18th century, and of course before that time, the enemy in the battle for the freedom of conscience was not so much the state as the church. The Catholic Church, with its arsenal of weapons, blasphemy, anathema, and excommunication, as well as its actual weapons of torture, the Church placed rigid limits on free thought. The writers and philosophers of the Enlightenment made it their business to challenge Church authority. And of course, in England, where my family came from, we suffered under religious tests for office in Anglican England, which required public office holders not only to swear an allegiance to the crown, which was the head of the state-sponsored church, but also to take communion in that church. You could not be an elected official in Anglican England unless you took communion in the Anglican church. And of course, there was Lutheran Sweden, and Catholic Spain, and Presbyterian Scotland, established religious states from which we fled. As Jefferson wrote in 1787, by the way, I know Jefferson's in the Hamilton play that Mr. Miranda wrote, might have been a much better character to focus on, just my personal opinion. In 1787, Jefferson, in his Notes on the State of Virginia, where he supported the separation of church and state, he wrote, "Millions of innocent men, women, and children, since the introduction of Christianity, have been burned, tortured, fined, and imprisoned. What has been the effect of this coercion? To make one half of the world fools and the other half hypocrites. To support roguery and error all over the earth." You see, Mr. Jefferson was not shy in his condemnation of the Christian religion. Not people's individual faith. That was not the target of the criticism of Jefferson or any of the founders. But this established thing called a church which sought power and money, that is what he criticized. We don't need to speculate about what the founders believed. I have not found in my research that any of my writings have been published, but the writings of so many others are so easy to find now. I find myself wondering whether you Americans read it all. Or is it these little devices that you look at all the time? Perhaps you wouldn't be so ignorant about the history of your country if you put these down and spent more time reading. Did you know that there is now a published volume of the debates of the Constitutional Convention? If you want to hear both or all three or four sides on the issues that led to the Constitution being written as it was, you can read about it. What did Washington say? Not as impolitic an individual as Jefferson, by the way, much more cautious about what he said. But there are at least a couple of surviving didn't know they existed back then, but I know now. In 1784, in an advertisement that Washington wrote as he was looking for some workers, here's what he said to those who might apply. "Mahometans, Jews, or Christians of any sect, or they may be atheists, as long as they are good workmen." You see, the founders were pragmatists in matters of faith. They didn't judge those around them, those who worked for them, based on their beliefs. The measure of the man, and by the way, ladies, I must confess that I am so sorry that we hated women so much back then. I feel enlightened, and when I return, as I hope to do, to my proper place, I'm going to tell everyone, women get to vote. We should think about that. But back then it was all men, so I'll return to my story. The judgment was whether and in 1792, in another letter, then President Washington wrote, "Of all the animosities which have existed among mankind, those which are caused by a difference of sentiment and religion appear to be the most inveterate and distressing, and ought most to be deprecated. I was in hopes that the enlightened and liberal policy which has marked the public age would at least have reconciled Christians of every denomination, that we should never again see their religious disputes carried out to such a pitch as to endanger the peace of society." The words of President Washington in 1792. And somehow, you Americans are here again, 230 years later, with the same concerns. I happened to see some videos, again, on this little device, that showed some of the advertising for these people who are running for governor of your fair state of Indiana recently. It seemed to be a competition of who was a better Christian. Odd. We're going to talk about religious tests of office here in a minute. So there's not much more I can find from Washington. He kept his beliefs very close to his vest. He was a man of faith, a Congregationalist. He just didn't seek to impose his faith on anyone else. A lesser known but very influential founder by the name of Justice James Iredell. He was nominated by President Washington to the United States Supreme Court and served from 1790 to 1799. I'm sorry that you don't know his name. During the debates of the Constitutional Convention in 1788, he was writing about whether there should be a religious test for office in the Constitution. It's right there. Stand right here, I'm okay. Here's what Mr. Iredell said.
Every person in the least conversant in the history of mankind knows what
dreadful mischiefs have been committed by religious persecutions. Under the color of religious tests, the utmost cruelties have been exercised. Those in power have generally considered all wisdom centered in themselves, that they alone had a right to dictate to the rest of mankind, and that all opposition to their tenets was profane and impious. The consequence of this intolerant spirit has been that each church has, in turn, set itself up against every other church, and persecutions and wars of the most implacable and bloody nature have taken place in every part of the world. America has set an example to mankind to
think more modestly and reasonably that a man may be of different religious sentiments from our own without being a bad
member of society. The principles of toleration, to the honor of this age, are doing away with those errors and prejudices which have so long prevailed, even in the most intolerant countries. I should be sorry to find, when examples of toleration are set even by arbitrary governments, that this country, so impressed with the highest sense of liberty, should adopt principles on this subject that were narrow and illiberal. I consider the clause under consideration, which was the clause in Article 6 of the Constitution that says there shall be no religious test of office. I consider the clause under consideration as one of the strongest proofs that could be adduced that it was the intention of those who formed this system to establish a general religious liberty in America. But it is objected that the people of America perhaps choose representatives who have no religion at all, and that pagans and Mohammedans may be admitted into office. But how is it possible to exclude any set of men without taking away that principle of religious freedom which we ourselves so warmly contend for? This is the foundation on which persecution has been raised in every part of the world. The people in power were always in the right, and everybody else was always wrong. The words of James Iredell. And another eminent founder whose name I am so disappointed you do not know. If you do, raise your hand. Chief Justice Oliver Ellsworth, nominated to the United States Supreme Court by President Washington, the third Chief Justice of the United States of America, the very founder who coined the term United States, one of five members of the Constitutional Convention who authored our Constitution, and yet no one knows his name, Oliver Ellsworth. In a newspaper article published in December 1787, writing in favor of the no religious test clause, here's what Chief Justice Oliver Ellsworth said. Some very worthy persons who have not had great advantages for information, isn't that a great turn of phrase? Who have not had great advantages for information, in other words, they're ignorant as pigs, have objected against that clause in the Constitution, which provides that no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust. They have been afraid that this clause is unfavorable to religion. But my countrymen, the sole purpose and effect of it is to exclude persecution and to secure to you the important right of religious liberty. We are almost the only people in the world who have had a full enjoyment of this important right of human nature. In our country, every man, and I shall insert, and woman, has a right to worship God in that way which is most agreeable to his own conscience. If he be a good and peaceable citizen, he is liable to no penalties or incapacities on account of his religious sentiments. Or in other words, he is not subject to persecution. My friends, as you can see, this is not a band of atheists. It's not a band of heathens. A religious people who have enough confidence and faith in their own religious beliefs and their own security that what they sought was to separate government and religion, not to eliminate religion. In fact, they believed that the only way for religious faith to flower is to separate it from government. And of course, Thomas Jefferson. He wrote so much. The founder, most comfortable with Unitarianism, by the way. I'm not sure he ever quite stood up and said, "Hi, I'm a Unitarian," but he kind of did. Claim one of your own and embrace him. When he authored the Declaration of Independence in 1776, and let's admit he probably had some help from Madison, he speaks of the laws of nature and of nature's God. Certainly not a reference to Jesus Christ or Christianity. In 1782, in his notes on the state of Virginia, the legitimate powers of government extend to such acts only as are injurious to others. But it does me no injury for my neighbor to say there are 20 gods or no god at all. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg. Pragmatism. Just like Washington. This morning, as I came in with the rather dramatic song by Mr. Miranda about Hamilton, of all people, the lyrics raised the question of how did a ragtag group like us, I've cleaned up for today, by the way. Mr. Miranda said I needed a bath. I actually took a bath this morning. Raised the question of how we founders, a ragtag group, beat the British crown. And the answer was our quest for freedom. And I would submit it was primarily our quest for freedom of conscience. In 1786, Jefferson authored the Virginia Statute on Religious Freedom. And part of the text that was authored by Jefferson had the phrase, the holy author of our religion. Well, the Christians in Virginia thought it was vital to qualify that language by adding a comma, Jesus Christ, comma, so it would be clear who was the author of the holy author of our religion. In his autobiography, Jefferson wrote, "The insertion of Jesus Christ was rejected by a great majority, in proof that they meant to comprehend within the mantle of the statute's protection the Jew and the Gentile, the Christian and the Mohammedan, the Hindu and the infidel of every denomination." The spirit of the Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom was like the spirit of this Unitarian Universalist congregation. All are welcome. All are to be heard. And we are free together. You respect me, and I will respect you.
In the 1880 presidential
contest against John Adams, Jefferson
was rather disfavored by many. In fact,
there was a New York Presbyterian minister by the name of William Lynn who published a pamphlet opposing Jefferson on the basis that he rejected Christian religion and even self-identified as a deist, for goodness sake. Lynn, as it turns out, was the first chaplain of the United States House of Representatives and the second president of Rutgers University, a rather prominent figure. Lynn acknowledged, because the Constitution had recently been ratified and adopted, that the Constitution did not prevent non-Christians from serving. Nonetheless, he argued that Jefferson should set his name to the first part of the Apostles' Creed in order to prove his character. Even though you're Unitarian Universalists, you probably remember the Apostles' Creed. I believe in God, the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth, and in Jesus Christ, his only Son, our Lord, who was conceived by the Holy Spirit, born to the Virgin Mary. Lynn and others who opposed Jefferson in the 1800 presidential contest wanted to impose on him a private political test of office. If you want our vote, you need to stand before us and submit to the Apostles' Creed.
And so, this recent governor contest, which seemed to be a race of who's the better Christian, this is not a new thing, friends. Jefferson
And now, so many famous things said by Jefferson. 1802, when he was president, he wrote a letter to the Danbury Baptist Association. Believing with you that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his God, that he owes account to none other for his faith or his worship, that the legislative powers of government reach actions only and not opinions. I contemplate with sovereign reverence the act of the whole American people, which declared that their legislator should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state. That is how America was founded, with a wall as high as they could construct between church and state. And let us not forget, as As Jefferson aged in 1820 at age 77, he wrote the Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth, which we now commonly, well, you, I now, commonly refer to as the Jefferson Bible. He edited the Christian Gospels. He removed the virgin birth, the resurrection, all of the miracles, because Jefferson cared about the teachings of Jesus, not the notion of some miraculous divinity. And so I have a gift for this congregation of the Jefferson Bible, an edition by a foundation formed by the Smithson family. Apparently there's some really neat museums in Washington, D.C. now. I had a very interesting exercise in purchasing this book. I went to a place called Online, and I was able to borrow a card of credit from Natalie Brake, very kind woman to let me borrow her card of credit. And in a few short days, she had me staying in her basement, by the way, this book from a place called Online showed up. You live in a very curious world. I do hope I get to stay here long enough to figure it out. When I go home, my friends aren't going to believe a thing that I have to say. Perhaps you not believing a thing I have to say now. The question of whether America was founded as a Christian nation if all else fails. Let's read the Constitution itself. Oh, Teresa, I have another quiz. And I have need for another volunteer. And that would be you, my dear. I have a copy of the Constitution here. I'm sure you know it. You probably learned it, memorized it as a child. You probably recite it every night before you go to bed, after you finish counting the sheep, or before you start counting the sheep. Here's the quiz. How many times does the word God appear in the Constitution?
Zero.
Great. How many times does the word Jesus appear in the Constitution?
Zero.
Zero again. Let's go for the trifecta. How many times does the word Christian appear in the Constitution?
Zero.
She deserves a prize. Thank you. There's a thing called fact and a thing called mythology. Fact. The best textual evidence of the wall of separation appears in the Constitution itself, even before the Bill of Rights were adopted in 1791. Article 6. Clause 3 of the United States Constitution, which relates to oaths of office, states, the senators and representatives before mentioned, and the members of the several state legislatures, and all executive and judicial officers, both of the United States and the several states, shall be bound by oath or affirmation to support this Constitution, but no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. In the face of Anglican England and the church that dominated Europe, the United States set forth on an experiment that says no longer shall there be a religious test of office. In fact, you can swear an oath if you choose, or merely an affirmation, which is non-religious in nature. All right, you might ask me, okay, Peter, fine. You've quoted some great language from some of the founders. You found some language in the Constitution. You want us to draw an inference from that about how it's obvious that America wasn't founded as a Christian nation. Is there anything else? Well, I wasn't surprised, because I know Unitarians and Universalists, although I just met Teresa today. I was listening through the door as she was talking, by the way. Because it's always good to know what someone says before you say something, so you don't embarrass yourself. And Teresa stole my thunder. But her thunder was so important, I'm going to repeat it. The Treaty of Tripoli, signed in 1796 and ratified by the United States Senate in 1797. It is the most explicit, unambiguous statement about which those who now try to argue a mythology can't overcome. As the government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion. Period. End of sentence. And as I had to say to my professors at Harvard, quod erat demonstratum. QED, my friends. America was not founded as a Christian nation. Natalie and Nancy as they were coaching me for today and how I ought to behave and told me to dress up like this, told me that there was something called an elevator speech. I have no idea what that means because I don't even know what an elevator is. But my sense was that she wanted to arm you Unitarian Universalists so that the next time you're at a dinner party or a cocktail party or a political event and you hear somebody talking some drivel about how America was founded as a Christian nation, what do you say? What do you say that's truthful, factual, not your speculation? Well, first, elevator speech, part one. Talk about the Treaty of Tripoli. The very words ratified by the United States Constitution in June, I'm sorry, the United States Senate in June of 1797. It's worth repeating again. As the government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion. There's the first part of your elevator speech. The second part of your elevator speech has to do with the Constitution as amended by the Bill of Rights in 1791. It wasn't the Seventh Amendment or the 11th Amendment. It was the First Amendment. Whew. It means so much to me, it starts to choke me up. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Overcome that, those who seek to tell a different truth. With those simple words, as the Constitution was amended and the Bill of Rights was adopted, the wall of separation between church and state was firmly in place. Part of my readings over the last 5 days, because I studied a little bit of law in my youth when I was at Harvard, I've read so many decisions of the United States Supreme Court. Rather boring, by the way. I'd urge you to read at least one opinion, but it's really quite boring. They like to talk a lot. But the United States Supreme Court over the years has just chipped away at the meaning of the First Amendment, what it means to establish a religion, what it means for people to be able to freely exercise their beliefs. I hope they're careful about that. America was not founded on Christianity or based upon any particular faith tradition. A framework was adopted so that you can choose what you believe. Live your faith if you choose to, or live no faith at all. And so now, I must somehow find my way home. Find that opening to that rabbit hole that takes me back to my birthday party on May 14 of 1813. I'm not sure my wife has really missed me. I think my children probably have. I would like to thank Natalie and Nancy again for their kindness, and particularly Natalie for letting me hang out in her basement the last few days. And to you for giving me this audience. It is my sincere hope that America will awaken from its own slumber. Remember and revere the facts, not the false mythology of its past. And never again fall victim to the ambitions of those who seek power and control over matters of faith and conscience. I've heard it said that I have a fifth great-grandson whose name is William, who lives in this area. I do hope that before I return to my own home that I'll have a chance to meet him. I have so much left to learn. Thank you.
financial contributions to this congregation come from sacrifice and hard work. We are so grateful for this and commit together to ensure the funds we gather collectively do a greater good for ourselves and our world than they could have done alone. For our visitors, please know that your presence is gift enough. For those who are not visiting, please consider giving to the church through the donation link found through the QR code on the back of the bulletin. Each month, our congregation chooses a local nonprofit to support with our offering. This month, the nonprofit is Family Promise in Hendricks County. Any cash offering collected in the plates at the back or side of the sanctuary will be given to this nonprofit. If you give a check offering, please note if it is for the church or the nonprofit. And Julian is pushing around the cart for food donations that will be donated to the food bank. Invite our members, friends, and guests to share the joys and concerns, sharing important events and happenings in our lives strengthens community and offers support to one another. Please come forward, take the microphone, state your name, and share your joy or concern, and place a stone in the water of our community.
Leave this place, seeking an uncharted and freely chosen way to wholeness, knowing we have companions along the way. The service has ended. Feel free to join us downstairs for coffee and conversation.